Hey everyone, and welcome to the Masters Athlete Podcast. I am your host, Rob Arnold, and I've spent the last 20 years in the exercise physiology field as a strength coach, personal trainer, wellness manager, health coach, and writer. Each week, I will bring you the latest research on injury prevention, strength and conditioning, nutrition, event preparation, and overall exercise physiology to the over 40 crowd of weekend warriors, seasoned triathletes, stay-at-home parents, and CrossFit athletes. Now, let's get on with this week's show. Hello, Masters Athletes, and welcome back to the Masters Athlete Podcast. I am your host, Rob Arnold, and I am thrilled to be presenting another week's worth of Masters Athlete information. But before we get started, I wanted to let you know that this podcast is sponsored by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is the leader in sports technology for athletes. Simply Faster has the world's best solutions for speed, power, endurance, rehabilitation, and recovery. Perfect for the Masters athlete, Simply Faster distributes the K-Box flywheel system, free lap timing, gym aware, and electrical muscle stimulators to help get ahead of the competition. To get yourself started, simply visit simplyfaster.com today. All right, well this week I thought I would do something just a little different. And I was inspired by a lot of the emails that I subscribe to that essentially provide links to websites throughout the whole interweb. And it's links that say Tim Ferriss or Dan John or Tony Gentilcore have thought that these are great articles and they want you to read them or they think that they're worth your while. So what I thought I would do today is take some links that I've read and just talk briefly about each of those articles and give kind of my thought on those articles and what some of the current events in Masters Athletes and strength and conditioning is. And so that's kind of what this week's episode is going to be. So hopefully you'll enjoy it. The first article is from a website called getpocket.com. And I actually received this from Dan John's newsletter. And if you haven't subscribed to his newsletter, I highly recommend it. It's always a wealth of information and it's sent out once a week and great stuff. So anyway, that's my plug for Dan John. Anyway, one of the links that he sent out this week was just a kind of an op-ed article on why it is easier to be skinny in the 1980s versus today. And Rob Wolf actually touches a little bit on this in his latest book, Wired to Eat. But what this article consisted of was a study that was published in the journal Obesity Research and Clinical Practice. And they basically said that it's harder for adults to maintain the same weight today as they did 20, 30 years ago, even at the same levels of food intake and exercise. So why do you think that is? Well, what they looked at was food, activity, age, BMI, and all of that stuff, and everything being equal, food intake, exercise intake, those type of things being equal, a person in 1988 would have a BMI that was 2.3 points lower than what they would nowadays. And that's roughly approximately 10% weight increase. So why is that? Well, they came up with some thoughts as to why that was, and they talked about chemicals in our foods that could be weight gain inducing, such as pesticides, flame retardants, those type of things, and they might alter our hormonal balances and processes in our body. Prescription drugs, it's obvious that prescription drug use is exponentially higher now, especially in terms of antidepressants, anti-anxieties, those type of things, and those wreak havoc on our weights. There's a lot of the use of prescription drugs has increased dramatically, so that has something to do with it. Our microbiome, and this is where I want to go. is the microbiome has changed in our guts. And it's because we take in a lot more toxins, not just through pesticides and whatnot, but we just take in more toxins in general. And we also eat more on average. So say in 1980, 1985, where we would eat 3 square meals a day, we're much more likely to graze nowadays with folks working from home a lot more, having access to just having greater access to food and snacks a lot more. We graze much more than we do or than we did back then. And so it changes our gut microbiome. And when our gut microbiome changes, it's a whole different ball of wax in terms of how our bodies function and what it does to our weight, what it does to our stress, what it does to our moods, all kinds of stuff, our autoimmune functions. There's so many studies coming out nowadays that talk about the gut microbiome and all of the processes that it deals with in the body. And the bottom line with that is that if you don't have a healthy gut, you're going to have problems, whether that's autoimmune function, whether that's weight gain, whatever it is. If you don't have a healthy gut, then you're going to have some problems. So the gist of this article that I took was take care of your gut, get plenty of diversified fiber, diversified vegetables. Don't eat in America. We're heavy meat consumers. I know I am, but we don't need as much. And the meat that we eat sometimes can alter our gut microbiome. And so what we need to do is get a diversity of foods, not just meat products, not just Cheetos, but get a diversity of fiber, lots of vegetables, lots of fruits, fish, seeds, nuts, those type of things. Provide a lot of good nutrition for our gut microbiome, and it'll help us in the long run. So that's my take for this article, and if you want to be slim like someone in the 1980s, and you know, take care of your gut. Right. The next article is from Cell Metabolism, the Journal of Cell Metabolism, and essentially I'll tell you the name of the article, and I'm going to have links to all these articles in the show notes. So click on the show notes, click on the links, and you'll go to all of them if you want to read for yourself. But this one here, alternate day fasting improves physiological and molecular markers of aging in healthy non-obese humans. So there's been a lot of studies that have taken that have looked at what fasting can do to those that are possibly diseased or obese. And what this particular one does is it looks for healthy non-obese adults, and it looks to see what alternate day fasting does to their body. And that's it. And what some of the results they found were pretty fascinating that I found. So alternate day fasting, that means you eat on Monday, no eating on Tuesday. You eat on Wednesday, no eating on Thursday, and so on. Okay, so alternate day fasting. So you're essentially fasting 3, possibly 4 days out of the week, and then getting your food the other days. So 4-week alternate day fasting decreases the body weight by 4.5% and improves the fat to lean ratio. I found that to be awesome. So to combat what our last article was, and this is why I chose these two back to back, to combat what the last article was, where it talks about, yeah, we're taking in equal amount of calories and exercising as much as we did back then, but we're weighing more. Well, we can help solve this by implementing an alternate day fasting routine, at least for just a little bit, maybe for a week or maybe for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, for at least just a little bit, and go from there and see what happens to our body. And in this study, 4-week alternate day fasting, the participants dropped 4.5% weight and they improved their fat to lean ratio, meaning their body fat percentage went down. That's fantastic. Cardiovascular parameters and cardiovascular disease risk are improved. Periodic metabolic fluctuations were improved. polyunsaturated fats increased, amino acids decreased, cholesterol decreased, ketone bodies increased, cardiac health increased, visceral body fat decreased. I mean, that all sounds pretty fantastic, don't you think? On fasting days, the pro-aging amino acid methionine, easy for me to say, was periodically depleted, while polyunsaturated fatty acids were also elevated. So pro-aging amino acids were depleted, and polyunsaturated fatty acids were elevated. Fantastic stuff. Fantastic stuff. Low-density lipoprotein decreased. And this, one of their conclusions is that alternate day fasting could eventually be a clinical, could eventually become clinically relevant as an intervention for those that are suffering from some of these disorders and diseases. So I found that fascinating. So couple that with the last article. One of the ways that we can combat some of the gut microbiome issues and promote autophagy, promote apoptosis, is by implementing an alternate day fasting diet and moving forward with that. And I really think that if we did that, we would be much better off in the long run. Another article that I read this week was from our sponsor, Simply Faster. Go check them out. Follow them on all social media platforms. Another one I read, which I encountered recently, the subject I encountered very recently when I went to the Masters Track Championships in Ames, Iowa, and something that I'm encountering as I attempt to plan to go to the World Championships in Toronto next year, and that's the title of the article is 5 Ways to Manage Travel Costs and Prepare for Success in Track and Field. And this could go for any sport, not just track and field, but any sport. It's obvious that traveling to events is a bit of a hassle. When I looked at what it's going to cost me to go to Toronto next year, the way that the meet is set up, the way that the events are set up, I'm going to wind up being there for 6 total days. And that if I go there with my wife, that's going to cost upwards of $4,000 or $5,000. And it's going to turn into, you know, quite an event if I'm going to do it right. And so that's something that athletes have to think about. You know, Ironman, folks that do Ironman, you know, not just are they paying, you know, between $500 and $1,000 for entry fees, but they're paying all kinds of expenses to lug all their equipment, their bikes and everything all over the country. So it's an issue. So one of the ways that they talk about is be strategic with your meat selection. And so I did that this year when I did my, some of my regional track meets, is I wanted to make sure that I could travel there by car in one day and I could get there in one day, do the meet and come back. And I also wanted to take into account the fact that I could travel there by car and it would not have an adverse effect on my performance, meaning I didn't want to drive more than 2 or 3 hours and then compete and then drive 2 or 3 hours back. Because if I drove more than 2 to 3 hours at a time, that would negatively, I felt, it would negatively affect my performance at what I was doing. So say, for instance, when I went to the Indiana State Championships for Masters USATF, that was about a 2.5 hour drive from where I live. Any further than that, I don't think that I would have done it. I had entered a meet that was in Nashville that's about 3 hours away. And I wanted to make sure that, it was within that window of opportunity, that window of drivability that I had to where it wouldn't affect me negatively when I ran. You want to look at weather conditions and what's the competition quality. When I looked at a couple events that were there was one in Lexington, Kentucky, and when I started analyzing who was going to be at the event, I was going to be the only one in my age group. So for me, for somebody that was trying to get into tip-top shape and to see where I was regarding, you know, where I stood with people that I was going to race against in Ames. Running against myself didn't really serve a purpose. I mean, it really didn't. So I had to kind of weigh the negatives and positives with that one, because I just saw that, you know, the quality of competition simply wasn't going to be there. In fact, it wasn't going to be there at all. So why even go? I mean, it's a meet, and I would have gotten a medal, but why even go if I'm not running against anybody in my age group and it's not going to give me any kind of competition? So I didn't do that one at all. So that's something that we need to look at, is, you know, be strategic with your meet selection. Don't sign up for every meet and every race that comes across in your area. Another one is take the time to research your flight options. And there's a lot of different ways to do this. In today's world, you have, you know, cheaper airlines like JetBlue and Southwest and Allegiant. You've got your apps that will look up flights for you, and or Google Alerts. Google Flights will send you alerts when a flight in your area has hit a certain price point that you've set for it. So that's all, that always helps. And I'm a big fan of Google Flights, so that's something that I'm paying attention to for Toronto next year. Heck, Toronto is actually 9 hours from me, so if I drove up 48 hours in advance, it really wouldn't be that bad of a deal. But I'm still looking at flights. But so anyway, so look at your cheaper airlines. You know, look at bag prices, because airlines nowadays are charging for carry-ons and luggage. Try and tap into points if you have a credit card, and have a backup plan in case your flight gets canceled or delayed. You know, that's a big one, is, you know, if you're planning on flying in the day before an event and something happens to your flight, you're kind of screwed. So have a backup plan. Okay. Hotels, make sure you book through cheaper sites such as hotels.com, Hotwire, those type of things. A lot of times you can call the hotel directly. If you have a loyalty program, like through Hilton or Marriott or whatever, and they might give you a discounted rate. Make sure that you use points if they're available to you, and, find a hotel that isn't necessarily the closest to the event, but it can still get you there and it might be cheaper. So say, you know, for instance, I stayed in a place in Des Moines that was in Des Moines, but the meet was in Ames, and that's a 45-minute drive, so it really wasn't that bad. I was able to stay for a whole lot cheaper and still get to Ames and not worry about time at all. So if you got to stay, you know, 5, 6, 10 miles away further than what you anticipated, that's not a problem. Okay, that's not a problem. Most hotels have shuttles, so it shouldn't be an issue. And with the advent of Uber and Lyft, that shouldn't be an issue either. So pick a location that is conducive to what you need to do, and make sure that you book through cheaper sites. Again, ground transportation, utilize the shuttle as much as possible. Meals, for one, I like to stay, and this is an overarching thing for this article, I like to stay at Airbnbs, because I'm able to choose my meals that I want and cook the meals that I want and pack accordingly and go to the grocery store, get everything that I need, and not have to worry about getting some kind of issue with food at a restaurant. So, you know, as far as hotels and ground transportation goes and meals, I like to get an Airbnb. I can fix my own meals and make sure that I'm taking care of myself as far as that goes. So, you know, make sure that you're looking at flights well enough ahead of time, hotels, Airbnb, all that stuff. Make sure you're choosing your food ahead of time. And you can even, like for certain grocery retailers like Kroger or Whole Foods, you can order groceries on their app and have it set up for pickup or delivery on a certain day. And so you could have them deliver the groceries to you when you're in town. So that way you don't have to worry about driving there and picking them up and driving back. You can have them delivered to you. So that's fantastic, and I highly recommend it. And that's a way to keep from eating out and getting expensive food while you're eating out at restaurants. So that's my synopsis of that article. Again, 5 ways to manage travel costs and prepare for success. We all run into those problems, so definitely something to take a look at. Next article is from the Poliquin Group, and if you're familiar with Charles Poliquin, God rest his soul, he was a super genius, and he died far too young and far too recent. So, but his group, his editorial group, is still putting out some great content. And one of the most recent articles that they've put out, actually this was a couple of years ago, one of the articles that they put out was 9 amazing ways to reduce post-workout muscle soreness. So we all know what that is, DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness. And we've all suffered it once or twice or 30 times. And so oftentimes we look at DOMS as an indicator of how hard we worked. And unfortunately, that's not something that we want to do. We don't want to look at delayed onset muscle soreness or DOMS as an indicator of how hard we worked. Oftentimes, it's an indicator of how untrained we are and how out of shape we are. And so something that I always did with my clients is I never wanted to have them sore after their first, second, or third workouts. Because for me, in my mind, if a client comes to me and I work them out and make it to where they can't get out of bed the next day, then they're not going to want to come back to me. They're going to be like, screw this guy. He put me in pain. Why do I want to keep doing this? Some folks, on the other hand, thought that was great. This is me. This is what it should feel like. No pain, no gain. But that's not how it is. So we want to not necessarily get DOMS, but we always will get it, but we don't want to have that be a goal for us. So one of the things that they talked about, eccentric contractions contribute more to DOMS, genetics, it varies by individual, it varies by the muscle groups. I can't tell you if I've ever received delayed onset muscle soreness in my shoulders. In my legs, yes. I could take 1 week off of leg training and I'll get severe DOMS the first leg training day back. But I don't think I've ever in my life received DOMS in my shoulders. So for me, I mean, that's just how it is. And I know that, if I take a week off of legs, I know that I'm going to have to come back into it gently. DOMS can be aggravated by stress. Common treatments such as ice really doesn't help much for delayed onset muscle soreness. Taking anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen, please don't, because that's bad. It inhibits your body's production of prostaglandin, which helps repair muscles. So don't do that. Static stretching does not do anything for DOMS. So before or after your workout, That's not gonna keep DOMS from happening. Okay, so what can help, and these are all possibilities. These are possibilities that are written in the article. They're not set in stone, but they're something to think about. Caffeine. Caffeine helps reduce DOMS. Science suggests that caffeine reduces soreness because it blocks central nervous receptors related to pain. So that's good. So maybe a little bit of caffeine, such as 5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, helps. And this is about the equivalent of 2 to 2.5 cups of coffee a day. So that's not a ton. I know of some folks like to take in about 3 or 4 Red Bulls a day, or a couple of large lattes a day. But 2.5 cups of coffee a day should be sufficient. Branched chain amino acids. These have been shown to help by increasing protein synthesis and reducing muscle breakdown. There's also evidence that taking leucine by itself, which is a very popular branched chain amino acid, that is not effective in decreasing DOMS, and that so you need all of the branched chain amino acids to help. Okay. Taking taurine, with branched chain amino acids helps because it creates a synergistic effect on reducing stress, aiding cardiovascular function, and reducing muscle damage. A couple of others that I'll kind of just fly through. Topical menthol, such as Bengay or Icy Hot or any of those types of ointments help. Precondition your muscles to reduce DOMS after taking time off, like kind of like what I just said. You know, if I missed legs for a week, I'm going to maybe ride the bike and then do some lighter squats and not as many, like a very low volume, low intensity squat day, getting back into it. And train more often. It's well known that adaptation gets rid of or decreases the amount of DOMS that we have. So the more often that we train will absolutely help. Acupuncture helps reduce DOMS. We don't really know exactly the mechanism or the physiology behind it, but it has been shown to help. And tart cherry and blueberry juice is something they talk about as helping DOMS. So that's definitely, those are some ways to help reduce DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness, and help reduce that that pain in your muscles that come after we work out. Finally, the last article I want to talk about is something that hit me the most, and I could probably talk for an hour on it, but hopefully I can stop after 5 minutes. But this one, again, is from the sponsor of the episode, Simply Faster, and the title of it is Debating Speed. Is Acceleration, Max Velocity, or Speed Endurance Most Important? And it's something that I really struggled with during my training in the last year. Did I want to focus on acceleration? Did I want to focus on max velocity or speed endurance? Well, I did things a little backwards. And I know that I am a relatively good max velocity guy as far as 100 and 200 goes. But for this year, I got into my head that I wanted to do the 400. Well, that requires a lot of speed endurance. And so what I did is I trained for the speed endurance, something that I've never done before in my entire life. I've never run the 400 in my life. And it absolutely negatively affected my acceleration and my max velocity regarding the 100 and the 200. Now, on days, I did dedicate one acceleration day of my training per week for acceleration. And that was basically just getting out of the blocks, getting 0 to 60 in as fast as possible, you know, lowering my 20 meter start down as low as I could. But I, looking back on it, I wish I would have done more because I know that my strength is 100 and 200. But I trained for the 400 and I didn't get that maximum velocity that I needed to get the most out of my 100 and 200. When you look at 100 and 200 in sprinting, you get to your max velocity, that acceleration, you should be at your max velocity 30 meters, but you can't really hold on to it. You can't really hold on to it past 60 to 70 meters. And so for me, I should have been focusing on holding on to that max velocity rather than speed endurance of a 400. And so anyway, I took a lot of personal note from this article, and I know that in the future, because I know what my strengths are, I'm going to go back to doing the acceleration and max velocity that I should have been doing all along rather than the speed endurance. That said, it's important to know what you're training for. If you're training for an 800, obviously speed endurance, same with a mile. You know, you don't really need to know what your acceleration is, and you don't really need to develop high acceleration when you're going, you know, a mile to 2 miles to a 5K to possibly a 10K. But when it comes to the shorter sprints, and this could be in swimming and cycling as well, You just need to know what's more important for you, for what the type of race that you're doing. And again, what I took out of it was knowing what my acceleration is, knowing what my max speed is, knowing how, where my deceleration is, you know, when do I start slowing down? So like, let's say on a 200, if I'm running a 200, I know, and this hit me this past year, I knew that I hit the wall on a 200 right at about the 160 mark. And that's where I started to really slow down and decelerate. And so for me, that's knowing that, I need to work on my speed endurance just for that. But if my max acceleration and if my max speed and acceleration were higher at the beginning, I would be able to finish that deceleration point. I would be that much further ahead and be that much better off in the long run. So hopefully that made sense. Probably didn't, but hopefully it does. It makes sense in my mind. So anyway, read the article. As far as track speed is concerned, maximum speed, maximum velocity is the key. I think we should all be working on maximum speed. Tony Holler preaches it. I mean, fast people run fast. That's how it is. Fast people run fast. You can't train a cheetah to run fast by jogging. You know, it's not going to happen. You can't train a cheetah to run 100% if they're just going to be running, you know, 60% or 70% for 8 repetitions at a time. It doesn't translate very well. So max speed is the key to all track speed, I feel. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on for the next couple of years that I get back on the track. Hopefully my heel heals up and we'll move forward from there. So anyway, those are the articles. Hopefully you reach out, click on the articles in the show notes and check them out. I think they're good articles, and let me know what you think of the show by shooting me an email on mastersathletepodcast@gmail.com. Check me out on Facebook at Masters Athlete Podcast, on Instagram at rbarnold2626, and anywhere social media is, I'll be there with the Masters Athlete information. So hopefully you liked it. Let me know. Give me your thoughts, and I'd love to hear from you. Thanks.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.